I'm Joan Brooks. I was born in the UK. I came out here in the 50s. I went straight to Standard 1, and because I knew my tables and I knew my alphabet, I was treated very badly by the principal, by the teacher I had at the time. I went into teaching because from the time I went to school, I was determined to be a teacher. This has happened at 5 years old. I used to teach physics, and I used to use the Scottish exams for training my physicists. And in those days, we had university entrance, and they were either accredited if they were very good, or they had to sit if they weren't so good. Now we have the New Zealand Certificate of Education, which is a disaster. Nobody is allowed to fail, but in real life, you fail. You either win or you fail. You work hard or you don't work hard. It is not preparing people for life, and the New Zealand Certificate of Education has been a disaster. And I was determined to get out for two reasons. Firstly, because they brought in the four-term year. And secondly, I was determined to leave before the New Zealand Certificate of Education came in. Now, I was speaking to somebody recently, and they told me what I was talking was a load of bullshit. And it wasn't, because I can remember I was head of PPTA at the time. And at the time when they brought in the four-term year, they had all sorts of people, this is the government at the time, and I don't know who it was, who were there to represent their policy. They had the Fruit and Berry Pickers Association, they had Federated Farmers, they had the tourist industry, they had nobody from education. They were determined that our students would not be on the beaches during the height of summer, and they should not be on the mountains during the height of winter. And so we now have a holiday in April and July and October. So I was determined to get out before that. But at that time, we were well near the top in maths and spoken English and written languages. Now we're well down towards the bottom.
Yeah, you're talking about the top around the world or what?
Yes, around the world.
Well, it sounds a bit of a shame to see the system go down. Can you just tell us a bit about the previous old system and what was so much better about it?
Well, teachers have never been valued in this country.
I think the British teachers would say the same, post maybe 1970s, 1980s. I think after the Second World War and the Butler Report in Britain, there was a real determination to educate the whole population the best they could possibly do that, including bright council school children. Mm-hmm. And there was a real pride in the job. 1970s, 1980s, that sort of turned around. And now a lot of teachers are getting out of the profession because they see it as much a pen-pushing job, spending much more time on admin than actually teaching. And also the teaching itself being prescribed by the Department for Education rather than saying, here's the textbook, get on and teach it in your own way.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And they've always been very, very badly paid. Now, I read the other day about a secondary school teacher who's living on her own, who is about to lose her house because when the interest rates went up, she went and had some more money from the bank, and the bank gave her an interest-only loan that's only for 12 months. And because the rate of inflation has gone up so much and interest rates have gone up so much, she is going to lose her house next year. Now, this is the situation. Auckland cannot get teachers because they can't afford to live there. Mm. Now, when I was working, you do 3 years at university. You do a whole year at training college, and you start off on, I've forgotten what we started on, but the police had 6 weeks training in Trentham, and they got nearly twice as much as we did.
I think some people say that all public sector workers should get a roughly the same sort of wage, and that they should also get the same increase, not to have to, you know, kind of tussle and negotiate every year. But anyway, look, you know, we're talking here about the New Zealand education system. At what age did you come from the UK? Because you arrived here from Britain, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was about six or seven, I think. Went into Standard 1, so I don't know the year I arrived.
And what did you make of the country as a youngster?
Well, I believe firmly that when in Rome, you do as Romans do. This is why I don't believe in mosques and chadors and scarves. When you go to China and everything is owned by the government, and yet they can come here and they can buy our land. Now, I don't agree with that. The Maoris were not indigenous people, although the government of this time say they are.
But I'm just trying to get to your impressions as a child, first coming here. From where? In London? Was it in the UK?
No, I was in a little village called Aspley Guys. It was in Bedfordshire. And I don't think most children look upon a new country as a new experience. I think most of them do. They don't start worrying about wanting to be at home, not like the mothers did. A lot of the women who came out missed their family and they wanted to go home. Children don't. They look upon every new experience as something new and something different.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people have been encouraged to come to New Zealand from England over the years. What was it that brought your parents out here?
Well, my father said the climate was to start with. But he was in insurance and in Britain. And when he came out here, he trained to be a primary teacher.
So, do you go back to the UK now?
Yes, I've been back two or three times. I've been back to where I live. I've seen the house. I had to see the bluebells. Yeah. But I got the feeling that every single inch of the land has been walked over. And when I came back here, I drove down through Wongamomina. And I looked into the bush and I thought, there are areas in that bush that nobody has ever trod on.
Yes, it's a much more, and I see sometimes these gravel roads are going out into, out into the bush, really. There are still people sort of buying sections and building completely fresh places, aren't there?
Yes, there are. And the Coromandel, when we first came here in the 60s, and we had a little batch down below, and it was a beautiful place. There were, in fact, Paku was covered in sheep. You wouldn't think it to look at it now. There were two buildings on the main centre. One was a local store, and there was a petrol station. Everything you needed, you had to bring. And we came down here weekend after weekend with our two children and loved it.
So you say a batch. So that the idea is that you were living in a city somewhere or in a town somewhere and teaching there, and it was a sort of little holiday home.
Yes,
but I mean, that's a tradition over here, isn't it? Quite a lot of, actually, the Russians do something very similar with their dachas. You know, they have a little place in the country. The French do the same sort of thing too.
Well, I think more and more people, they don't want a batch. They want a house, and they want a mansion away from their mansions in the city. I mean, we lived on the shore in the city, and our little batch had no power, it had no running water, it had a long drop, our shower was a kerosene can with a burette clip on it, and that's how we lived. And we came down for a break. We used to go out fishing, we'd just go out to shoe, catch our dinner. We could free dive out to slipper, 15 feet of water, we could get scallops. Nowadays, you can't even catch fish if you go out to the Alderman.
Why is that? I mean, is this regulations, trying to stop people fishing, that sort of thing, bureaucracy?
Too many people. Mm-hmm. Too many people around, too many boats.
You know what? When I was last year in 2021 up in North Norfolk, it was quite similar. It was a place which had its own kind of indigenous population of locals and who'd seen literally thousands of retirees moved to North Norfolk, buy houses. The house prices had added sometimes up to two noughts on the end, you know, with an average house price of something like 800,000, which obviously the locals can't. So there was a similar thing going on there. I think that is a lot of these rural communities, particularly coastal places, have changed, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And I think it's happening all around the world. And a lot of the young people who are brought up in the community can no longer afford to buy houses there. And so they leave.
Anyway, so let's get back to your... You mentioned the Maoris. You said the Maoris are not indigenous. Now, this is a little bit potentially contentious, isn't it? Because the Maoris are treated by this Jacinda Ardern's Labour government as very much the indigenous population that have been wronged in the past.
Well, if you speak to a lot of the old Maoris, they would agree that they are not indigenous. The Morioris were here beforehand. And I can't understand the government giving some money to the retaining Morioris and at the same time pretending that the Maoris are indigenous. Now, this was started by the national government, and John Key sent Sir Peter Sharples to the United Nations to say they were indigenous. Now, when I was teaching, I heard Peter Sharples give an address to the senior staff, and his words were, "The history of the Maori is as great as that of the Greeks." Now, I nearly walked out. I was so cross, because it's a ridiculous thing to say. And he then went on to say, the Maoris had universities. Now, for God's sake, they didn't even have wheels.
So who are these Maoris? Can you tell us a bit about them? I mean, we're taught, aren't we, that the Maoris came from Polynesia and that they maybe originally, there's a lot of anthropologists suggest that they came from somewhere around Korea, Taiwan, something like that, moved through using their catamaran-type boats through the Pacific Islands and eventually came to New Zealand. So you're saying that there were indigenous people when the Maori arrived?
Well, I don't know anything about the Moriori. I don't know where they came from. All I know is they've been here a long time. There are walls down the country that have been cut off from all people, from all research. There are stone cottage floors up north that have been cut off by the Maoris. Nobody's allowed to investigate them any further. The Morioris, I believe, were a very peaceful people. The Maoris are a very warring people, and their tribes were always at each other. Now, I read a book written by a young man in England who joined the Navy to come out to Australia to do sealing. And John lent me this book, and I found it very interesting. But while he was sealing and whaling, they came from Australia and they came to New Zealand and they also caught seals and whales. Now, he said at one stage that the Maoris used to invade a tribe and they used to take the nine-year-olds and the chief used to tie them behind their canoe and tow them till they drowned. Now,
well, that sounds like the sort of crime that the Royal Navy might have been up to back in the day.
Well, I don't know. I
mean, the British Empire wasn't sort of soft touch, was it?
Yes, that's true. And all around this area, there are fortune tellers, whether you believe what they say, but there are fortune tellers who come here and say, this place is not nice. The background is not nice. And they found so many skulls. A slipper was apparently a prison island, and they used to send their prisoners out there. I heard they cut their tendons so they couldn't escape, and they were meat on the hoof. The Maoris were known for their violence. The Morioris were peaceful. Now, on this...
Well, I think if you look at the All Blacks and the Haka, you can see that they're quite... That could be, you know...
I don't like rugby anyway.
Well, okay. But, I mean, it certainly doesn't look as if it's a peaceful religion, does it?
No, it doesn't.
But the thing is that I think with the empire, there was this sort of soft touch of sending in the clerics and the priests. Mm-hmm. And then once the indigenous population had been softened up, that's when the trouble started, because people would be infiltrated in. And the British were, you know, pretty ruthless too. They were all after land. They've always been fighting after land.
They were, but a lot of the Maoris signed the Treaty of Waitangi in order to prevent themselves from being wiped out.
Okay. Can you say something about this treaty?
Now, I've only believed what I've read over years and years and years. Half the Maoris supported the treaty, and they wanted the protection from Queen Victoria. The other half were against the treaty, and they turned on the Maoris that signed the treaty.
Isn't that interesting? That sounds like a British divide and rule tactic. We've done this in many places. I say we, you know, our predecessors.
Well.
So the Maori were at each other over the treaty.
They were at each other over the treaty, but the Morioris were very peaceful people. Now, I had read that a tribe that was being pursued fled to the South Island, and they fled to the Chathams, I think it was, where the Moriori's lived, and they were nursed back to health by the Moriori's. When they were healthy, they repaid the Moriori's by killing them all. Now, this is the way the Maoris work. I have lived next to a Maori who was a fine man. We have some fine examples of Maori in our community. But a lot of the people at the top are more English, they're more Irish, they're more Welsh, and it's as if their little bit of Maori blood, be a 16th or even a 32nd, is the only thing that matters. Their English blood doesn't matter, their Irish blood doesn't matter, their Scottish blood doesn't matter. And ACT Party, and I've never been a supporter of ACT, but they have a Maori woman in their party, and she married somebody from Borneo, I think. He was a political refugee. And so her children are half Borneo and half Maori. And she said she has been accused of being a born-again Maori. She has been accused of being stupid and told to go back and get her Maori roots. And she said her children count for nothing. Unless they say they're Maori, they are supposed to completely forget their Borneo side. Now, that is not right.
But it is difficult, isn't it, these days for people to get a kind of settled culture. But look, I mean, this is something which has come to the fore, hasn't it, with the Labour Party and particularly with Jacinda. And it's difficult for anyone to criticise Jacinda because she, a couple of years ago, was voted back in, wasn't she, you know, with quite a big majority. So somebody in New Zealand must like, in fact, the majority of people in New Zealand, as you've got a proportional representation system, must be supporting what she's doing. So do you want to just say something about her and then about what she's doing about Indigenous rights here?
Well, she was only elected to power because Winston Peters, who was the kingmaker at the time, refused to work with National. He would only work with Labour. Labour were in disarray. She came from nowhere. She hadn't even held a ministerial post, and she was the leader, and so she got in. That government was absolutely disastrous. The National Party then went through a period of disarray. Bill English, who was a very good man, resigned. John Key resigned, and they had a series of leaders that they didn't like, and so she got voted back in again. But she will not get voted in 2023. I guarantee it. Because although her popularity is dropping rapidly and she is still the most popular Prime Minister, the Labour Party has gone down and down and down and down, and now there's no hope.
So why is that? What have Labour been up to?
Oh, because the ministers are so incompetent. There's not one minister in there who has any experience in the role they have. They've spent so much money on reports, which I don't think they can even read to understand.
So on the ground, though, what's been happening on the ground to annoy people? I mean,
absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. She came in promising to do this and to do that and do the other thing. She hasn't kept one single promise. And yet, Bill Robinson, our Minister of Finance, came out and said the other day that something is mandatory to them staying in power. Now, we hadn't even heard about this when they got elected. It came out later. This is why I say we're just told lie after lie after lie. Their policy is kept hidden until, I mean, Three Waters was dumped on us.
What's that?
Three Waters. Drinking water, waste water, and what's the other water? What everybody is annoyed about and what councils are annoyed about is that the government intends to take over all the water system of every council in the country, give them a pittance. I mean, Auckland water is worth millions and millions of dollars. And then run it. But the Maoris have a say in what happens. And a lot of this money will go to Maori organisations.
Well, hang on. I mean, in New Zealand, quite a lot of houses aren't actually on the water system, are they? They're working through springs or boreholes, I would imagine, and maybe septic tanks, and they're off-grid, really.
That's right. Now, Sharon Johansson, who is in Pauanui, had an email from a guy who said, I'm okay because I'm on tank water. I get water off my roof. Now, I don't know if this is true. She said, don't worry because they will measure your roof and they will measure how much water and they will tax you accordingly. And a lot of that money will go to the so-called Maori, who are more English, more French, more Scottish, more Irish than Maori. And the people at the top of the tribes get a huge amount of money. They live like kings. And the people at the bottom are still sucking on the taxpayer.
So what about, there are two big things that have been happening recently. One is the centralisation of government. Another is the farming changes. And there was actually, just as I was arriving here, I think it was maybe it was the 20th or so of October, there was a massive rally in Auckland of farmers, basically saying we're refusing to go along with these changes you're trying to do here. So maybe you could start with what's happening in farming. Because, I mean, one of those things I've figured out over several visits to New Zealand is there seem to be three main industries. One is construction, including keeping the roads open. Another is tourism, and the other is farming. So for the government to be taking an aim at farmers and saying, well, actually, we're going to start to micromanage your farms and tell you what you can plant where, whether you're allowed to graze animals, and if you do a certain thing, we're going to tax you. Obviously, the whole farming community in New Zealand is going to get themselves organised, and they have done, under something called groundswell.
Well, this is something that's come from Jacinda, and she is only concerned about making waves to be the first in the world to do this. She is determined to be the first in the world under the auspices of global warming, and yet our farmers are renowned for being some of the best in the world for their carbon credits. What I don't understand is that they never can. I mean, carbon is a molecule. It's a definite molecule. You can't give out more carbon than you take in. They're only concerned about trees. Why are they not concerned about the grass? We're cutting down the Amazon at an alarming rate. Nobody thinks about the grass. They think about the carbon that the cows give out. How about the carbon that they take in from the grass? How about the carbon dioxide that the grass takes in to make the food? This is something that is never, ever touched.
Okay, so what about government as well? Because I know that there are attempts to sort of to cut down the number of local regions, local government, and bring them into one. I mean, we've had this in the UK to a certain extent, as the local authorities in Britain have been starved of finance from central government. So they've said, oh, well, you know, you can't do all the things you used to do. And so why don't you three or four local authorities all amalgamate into one? And of course, that means there's less representatives, less councillors, less, you know, people to vote for. So hasn't that been happening around here?
Well, you were at Focus yesterday and you heard Warwick Brooks talk about the fact that the Thames Coromandel District Council is about to be lost under the current government. It's all about, I mean, he was on about the local boards, the community boards. If he thinks the community boards now are ignored under the Thames Coromandel District Council, what on earth are they going to do under a wider council? It is all for taking power away from the people, and it's happening worldwide.
It certainly is, and I mean, it seems there's an attempt to centralise power. I think after the Second World War, it was quite clear that you had to sort of let people kind of get on with their own affair. That was really what democracy means. Yes. To divvy up the power, to say, no, don't have it all at the top, all in the central government. I mean, let's face it, that makes it easier for the big lobbies, the banking lobbies, the arms lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, all these lobbies find it much easier to get their way if power is centralised, say in Auckland or in London or wherever. You've had some experience of kind of engaging with this whole process round here. I think it's quite different to the UK in that a lot more people seem to actually get involved in trying to, you know, looking at where they live and suggesting ways to change it, ways to improve it. One of the things I've noticed, for example, is there are a lot of public toilets around. They're everywhere.
Do you know the last public toilet that was built down here cost over $900,000? Now, at that stage, you could build a house for that, but this is what the council spent. And I've heard that they've spent $5,000 on just putting a basketball post up.
But at least they're doing something. But in the UK, they're not doing very much. And public toilets have been all closed. I mean, pretty much in the cities.
This was a toilet that was used by the tourists. And the buses used to come here and they used to want to go to the toilet. Now, it was a toilet used by the tourists. And obviously, somebody in the know got the contract, $900,000, to put in a new toilet.
But anyway, that's the sort of thing that is quite useful to actually get going. In the UK, it's not really working very well. So could you just say something about how things work here when it comes to local government? And how people locally here, do you have any very much connection with Wellington at all?
None at all, except that I sign a lot of protest movements. But we were living in Auckland at the time that there were 9 councils all around the Auckland region. And then they decided to centralise it and make the super city. Now, the super city has been an absolute disaster. We lived on the shore. We had our own council on the shore. And the shore council looked after the shore people, what they needed, what they wanted. The South Auckland looked after the South Auckland people, what they needed, what they wanted. But now, with centralisation, you get a mayor from South Auckland, and the only place that benefits is the South Auckland area. And all 9 councils are bought into one. But we seem to get the wrong people on council too. I can remember when the government brought in fencing around swimming pools. They also insisted on fencing around spa pools. Even if the spa pools could be locked and they had a cover, they still had to be fenced. Now, a council in Waitakere, I think it was, decided that they wouldn't allow any furniture inside the fence. Now, this is stupid, because if it's outside the fence, children can climb over the fence and get into the pool, right? It's better to have it inside the fence. But it was a councillor who didn't have enough money to buy his own pool, so he was determined to threaten everybody else. All the pool owners went to court, and they won their case. The council had to back down. Now, one of our neighbours in Castor Bay tried to get on the council, and I thought, you're an idiot. Is this the sort of councillor we want? Now, I was talking to the mayor of the North Shore Council, and he said the mayoral positions have absolutely no power at all. The council is run by the people who are paid to be there every day, and they are the ones that make the decision, and the mayors have no decisions.
Well, I mean, the way it works in Bristol is the mayor gets to decide who those individuals are, who the officers are day to day. And so the mayor kind of, if the officers start playing up, the mayor gets rid of them and puts one of his own people in. But one of the other things that New Zealand's very well known for now, notoriously, around the world, is for this whole idea of zero. Not, we've just been talking about zero carbon with the farming, zero COVID. How did that all work? I was here myself when the lockdown started back in March, April 2020, and it was pretty strict. I understand it got even stricter after I left.
Well, to talk of zero COVID is absolutely ridiculous, because COVID now is increasing enormously all around the world.
Well, and here in New Zealand, the idea was to keep it out completely.
It was Jacinda's idea. She took 12 months to come up with any vaccination. I read a book recently called What Happened in Wuhan. Now, apparently, the lab from which it escaped, now this is only from the journalist who wrote the book. She's an award-winning Australian journalist, and she's spoken to many, many people. Apparently, the lab that from which it escaped was a collaboration with the French. The French designed it, and the French were supposed to build it. Once it was half built, the Chinese kicked the French out, and it came under the auspices of the military. Now, it was only a B-grade laboratory. It wasn't an A1 laboratory. Somebody who was kicked out of Canada for sending viruses to China set up in this laboratory, and she decided to contact a lot of bats, take their viruses, thousands and thousands and thousands of bat viruses, and she was playing around with bat viruses, and she inserted something in the bat virus that attacks the human lungs. Now, it escaped. Shortly after it escaped, the Chinese did a lot to change the B-grade laboratory into an A-grade laboratory. They put this into place and that into place, but it was too late.
Well, you say it's escaped. When are you talking about? Does this journalist... Who is the journalist? Who's the writer?
I can show you the book.
So the book's called What Really Happened in Wuhan, Shari Markson, Shari Markson, who's a Walkley Award-winning journalist, and its subtitle is A Virus Like No Other, Countless Infections, Millions of Deaths.
Now, she is Australian.
Yeah, okay. The Australian host of Shari on Sky News Australia, at the forefront of breaking news regarding the origins of COVID-19 pandemic since early 2020. But anyway, despite
she
what
was
we...
She previously political editor of the Daily Telegraph Media at the Australian.
I mean, I think many people would agree that this does look like some sort of lab release from China, the Pentagon being involved in funding research in that lab too.
Yes, they did, until Biden came into power and he stopped the funding.
Yeah, too late.
Too late.
Of course, too late. But anyhow, so...
In Wuhan, they had thousands of people piled up in the hospitals long before the world even knew about this virus.
So how did it all go down in New Zealand? Because there was this brave attempt by Jacinda, someone called brave, others stupid, to try and stop the virus coming to New Zealand by really sealing you off from the world. Now, you can understand that. New Zealand is one of the probably few places in the world that you really could potentially do that.
But you were allowed to bring, you were allowed to come back if you were a New Zealander. Doesn't matter where you'd be living. So you can bring the virus in if you're a New Zealander.
So how have things gone since, the mid-2020, when there was still this big attempt to keep COVID out of New Zealand?
Oh, well, now they don't bother with anything. You don't even have to wear a mask. But virus numbers are going up and up and up. In fact, I was talking to somebody today, and she said she's the only one in her village that hasn't got viruses. And she has... going to see a 91-year-old who's got COVID. A friend of mine who's in her 80s has had COVID. She didn't have it too badly, but now she's got what they call long COVID. That's what her nurse has told us she has. And she's a diabetic. She's an asthmatic. And she has said she's never felt so sick in all her life. And she had COVID, 3-4 months ago?
One of the rather worrying statistics now is that people who've had the vaccines seem to be going down with COVID more than those that haven't had vaccines. Well, one does wonder what the point of the vaccine is if it doesn't stop you catching COVID. I mean, I can remember back in the old days when you used to have, say, for example, a measles vaccine, and the idea was that you didn't catch measles. Now that's apparently not the case.
Yes, but measles is different. It's not a virus. I mean, you can catch a common cold over and over and over. You can catch the flu over and over and over. And a lot of people have the flu injections every year. Some people are so sick after the injection. Other people, it doesn't worry them. It depends on your genes.
So what's the approach here now? No one really minds anymore. It's all been forgotten. Was the whole zero COVID thing then just a complete failure?
Well, I don't think you can really blame Jacinda for deciding that it was going to be zero COVID. But there is no doubt that the government left the vaccine far too late. And I think the world at large, I mean, Iceland has, for instance, they were one of the first to say, to hell with it, to hell with all vaccines, all masks, just carry on as usual. Treat it like the flu. But unfortunately, it's a very severe form of flu, and it causes deaths. Now, what I would like to know is, how many deaths do we normally have each year, and how many deaths are attributed to COVID? Now, a friend of mine has a father who died recently, and he was due to die anyway through septicemia. But he caught COVID just before he died, and he's gone down as a COVID death. Now, it wasn't a COVID death, but he will be on the list of statistics as a COVID death, and it wasn't.
I mean, you're amongst a quite largely elderly community here, lots of people retired. Have you got any stories of people that you knew to do with COVID? Because, I mean, most people I've spoken to seem to have some story of somebody close to them, maybe a neighbour, maybe a close relative who's really been seriously affected by this in a way that possibly could have been helped if the government had got it right.
Well, the only people I know of, my son has caught COVID. He had just a bad throat. So far, he doesn't have long COVID. I suppose he's in his 50s. Sally, who's in her 80s, she's very, very sick. I don't know of anybody else, but we went out to dinner on Sunday night with a couple who her children had just come back from Australia, and they flew in on the Saturday. And Monday, Leanne wasn't feeling very well, and they both tested positive for COVID. So we test ourselves every second day. So far, we're fine. But I don't believe in drugs. I've always been a natural person. I eat well. We take our vitamin C every day. Dot, who rang me today, said, I take your colloidal silver every day. And she said, that's probably why I'm the only person in the village who doesn't have it. But I think it has a lot to do with your genes.
Yeah, there are two sort of different approaches, aren't there, that most people have taken. One is to identify the various supplements that will help your immune system, things like vitamin D, zinc, things like this, which is helping your own immune system. And there are others that really say, well, actually, look, these pharmaceutical companies know what's best. Let them stick anything into my arm. I'm sure it's fine.
Well, I think if you have a look at the number of people who protested against vaccination at all, I had the vaccine. Let's face it, I had my double dose. But I know a lot of people who didn't, and they protested in Wellington. And I think they have a right to decide what is put into their body. I think it is wrong to dictate what people should or shouldn't do with their own bodies. If they want to catch COVID and they die as a result, well, that's their choice.
I suppose to wind up, we could bring some of these subjects together and talk a bit about the press over here. I noticed that it does seem as if, for example, your I think it's called ZB News Talk or something. One of these radio stations in New Zealand has been doing such a good job in tracking the government that Jacinda has decided she won't be interviewed by their main political reporter, refuses any interviews by them, which is obviously a good sign that they're doing their job. What do you make of the press here in New Zealand, for good and bad?
Well, I get the paper, I get the Herald, and I only do it because I enjoy doing the puzzles. My husband reads it and he complains bitterly about the number of sob stories in the left-leaning paper. I don't listen to the radio and I don't listen to TV much because I am sick of the Maori language that has been forced on us. Even the weather now is in Maori. And they talk about our main centres. Some of them have Maori names, some of them don't, but they want to change all of them to Maori.
Well, look, hang on. The Maori would say, but you forced the English language on us.
How far back do you go? How far back do you go to say enough is enough and we need to move forward? We need to work as a team. Jacinda talks about this team of 5 million, which is ridiculous because we're not allowed to think our own thoughts. But there was a time when you were not allowed to speak Maori in schools, but not as recently as the Maori are making out. Not nearly as recently. But to change, a lot of our communities have Maori names, some of them don't. Why can't we have a combination of the two? A lot of our streets, we live in Motuhoa Road. It's Paku is a Maori name. Tairua is a Maori name. But a lot of the streets around here don't have Maori names. Some of them do, some of them don't. Why don't we have a bit of both?
Well, I think there is a little bit of both. But, I mean, Australia seems the treatment of the Indigenous people in Australia was a lot worse. I mean, it may be wrong, but I get the impression that there was more of an attempt by the British Empire back in the 1700s, 1800s to accommodate Maori here rather than to literally browbeat and slaughter as has happened in Australia. I mean, for example, with hunting down the last Aboriginals in Tasmania with on horseback with dogs, this kind of thing. So, I mean, surely, you know, the British have turned up. They're doing a lot of stuff here. Like, for example, they've stripped most of Coromandel of most of its trees to sell back in those days. But there was an attempt to say, well, actually, look. Let's make an accommodation with the people who were here before we were, rather than to just completely stamp our names all over it.
Yes, but they're not Indigenous people. The Aboriginals in Australia were the Indigenous people. I think the Aborigines have been treated very badly. But the Maori are not Indigenous. They were invaders, just like the British were.
And so what could happen next is maybe the Chinese will invade and put Chinese names all over everything.
Had the French or the Germans or the Portuguese or the Dutch invaded, there would be no Maoris left to complain.
Possibly. How do you think this is going to go, this relationship between the Maoris? Because, I mean, certainly, I don't know, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression that we get back in the UK is that there's actually quite a good relationship between the English invaders and the Maori, and that's actually one of the positive things about New Zealand as compared to many of the other colonies.
Well, when my father was working in, he's learning to be a teacher, in the holidays, he and my grandfather used to work at the wool stores. And they worked alongside Maoris who worked hard. And they worked hard. They were good guys. They got on well with them. And most of the Maoris we knew at the time, I mean, Dame Fina Cooper, I have a lot of admiration for. Dame Fina Cooper was a well-known Maori. And there was a golf course down there that the Maori wanted back. They wanted to take it back. It's a wreck today. And if you have a look at the farms, I used to do outdoor education. Now, the Maori farm on Waiheke was a thriving, good farm. It's not today. This is what's happened. There's an old saying, and you won't put this on air, as cunning as a Maori dog. You won't say that on air.
Okay.
But there are several types of Maori. There are those who work very hard and are prepared to work with us and for us. I worked with two Maori teachers. One of them was fantastic, and she started the kahangareo. The other one was hopeless. In the end, she was fired. Now,
I mean, surely the same exact thing is true for the English, the white people, yeah. So in a way, this distinction of race and culture is meaningless.
But all that matters now is who your great-grandfather is. If your great-grandfather or your great-great-great-grandfather was brown, you are supposed to be special. And the rest of your blood doesn't matter. Now, that is what is so wrong.
So how will this resolve itself, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know when the national government gets in next time, and I'm sure they will, I hope it'll be national and act, I don't know how it's going to resolve itself. I suspect that under Three Waters, a lot of people have left the council and they're already working for the government to try to get this Three Waters thing up and running. Now, they have probably got golden parachutes. How much is it going to cost to get rid of them? How much is it going to cost to undo the two health setups that we decided to put in the middle of a health pandemic? We have Maori health and we have health for the rest of us. I mean, it is ridiculous to do this in the middle of a pandemic. Our health system is in absolute disarray. Now, I don't know if it can be undone. It's going to cost a hell of a lot of money. Are we stuck with it?
Well, let's hope not. Joan Brooks, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been nice to talk to you, Tony.